You're listening to Opacity, a podcast about working in design. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. We've got a special guest in the studio with us today.
Do we?
We do. It's a former colleague of mine, Mr. Lara Veal.
Hey, Tom.
How's it going, Lara?
How are you, Lara?
Welcome on.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm enjoying the podcast so far.
Say more things like that.
I've been listening since you started, so yeah, really like it.
Excellent. What's your favorite episode?
I like the one with Aoife about the imposter syndrome. So that was quite an honest one. Mm-hmm. So that was very good.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, actually.
One of my favorites. I mean, I love them all equally.
But like children.
Boom.
Yeah. But Lars is probably, he's probably one of our favorite guests so far, isn't he? Because he brought donuts and he's saying good things about our podcast. So.
Well, it's one of the things I've learned from another designer. It's called Designers Do Donuts. So when you are delivering a talk, if you're doing a demo, if you're doing critique, if you bring a box of donuts, at least for the first 10, 15 minutes while you're speaking, other people have their mouths full, so you won't get any interruptions. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is kind of reciprocation. So you've done something nice for someone, so the first thing out of their mouths should be something at least reasonable, if not nice.
Wow.
So there is a secret to doing good demos with a room full of engineers.
Excellent.
That's a great tip. I think that's a good title for this episode, Designers Do Donuts.
Well, there is another podcast by Steve Portigal. He's a researcher called From Dollars to Donuts. So
nice.
So check that one out as well.
Does he use the same technique?
I don't know.
That's sweet manipulation.
I don't know. I'm a charmer at heart. So
yeah. Well, thanks very much for coming onto the podcast. You're obviously a well-seasoned, very knowledgeable designer. We've worked together in previous consultancy, and I've always found you a wealth of knowledge and someone who has a story and an anecdote and there's a bit of experience behind every challenge that I've come across. So can you tell us a bit about what you're doing at the moment? So we no longer work together. You're in a new role or the last year or so. Can you tell us a bit about what it is and what to do?
So I took the plunge after 12 years or 13 years of working for a UX agency, each and other, and I moved in-house to a company called AIB. So they're one of the big banks in Ireland. So I've been working on the business banking team for the last 17, 18 months. Yeah, so my first foray into working in-house since I last worked for AIB, which is kind of funny. Like a boomerang, I kind of went back. But
so that's where you worked before? You
came to the consultancy? I did a stint there of about 12 months before I joined IQ Content, Teach Another.
It's hilarious.
So I was a developer first. I was a developer for about 5-6 years. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had an epiphany about user-centered design that at the time I wasn't practicing it, nor were the teams I was working with. So more often than not, software that we shipped may not have been as successful as it could have been had we been following a more user-centered design process. So I decided to, well, there's something here. Back then, there wasn't much going on in Ireland. But I found a company that was kind of saying the stuff I was thinking. So I said, right, those guys are clearly for me. So I joined them.
Great. 13, 15 years later.
14 years later, I'm
putting years on your hair, sorry.
Yeah.
And
you call me seasoned. I think what you meant was I was old.
Seasoned with salt and pepper around the hair.
Yes.
I'm the same.
So, if you're working in-house, really, really enjoying the difference in that you get more time on something. It's quite an engineering kind of driven team that I'm on.
Yeah.
So bringing design to bear in there has been a challenge, but it's been a good one. So learning a ton as well about, you know, fitting design in with Agile and that kind of thing. But doing similar things that I did in each another. So learning better customers, learning better users, figuring out what it is they need and why they need it.
Yeah.
And then bringing that to bear in the product we're building.
Mm-hmm.
So when you joined AIB, was there a big kind of well-functioning design practice, or did you kind of come in with things a little bit more open-ended?
I would say probably open-ended in the current team I'm in, so the business banking team. However, they do have a design team on the mobile side. The mobile app is pretty good, and they've gone through a number of iterations. So what I'd say
it is good. I use it. So yeah.
It's, and we worked on it ourselves, Tom, years ago.
An iteration of it, yeah. Well, back.
So But yeah, so the design, some good designers and design teams there. I suppose they're just not evenly distributed around the bank. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those big companies that where design is not infused or embedded as much as it could be. Mm-hmm. So in terms of maturity model, it's probably not that mature in the organization. But that's kind of one of the jobs is to help make design, you know, mm-hmm. A bit more part of the furniture than it is right now.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And you're saying there's a lot of, it's like a kind of an engineer-led team or it was when you came in. Is there any kind of tactics that you've used or methods that you've used to kind of infuse more design, I won't say design thinking as in like the term itself, but like more thinking about design into the team?
Well, I suppose, well, the first thing is it's engineering driven in the sense that it's an IT project. They're replacing old technology with new full stack, yes, all the way down to the service layer, all that kind of stuff. So, but in doing so, it needs to serve our customers.
Yeah.
So, and what I've been really impressed by over the last 18 months is culturally, I know Ireland had a tough time with the banks or, you know.
Yeah.
So their brands were very tarnished as a result. But internally, the internal brand is really, really strong, and you will not pass a floor or a meeting room where it's not stated somewhere that, you know, we're backing our customers.
Yeah.
So I think that's incredibly powerful. And that's where I feel that kind of UX in particular has a particular affinity with the brand right now. Mm. So, you know, they're kind of lockstep together. But in terms of the tactics, just the good stuff, like understanding who the user is. So we've done a lot of field research. So going out and talking to customers and asking them simple questions like, show us how you work. Why do you do it that way? Mm-hmm. What else do you use? Who else do you work with? Very much open questions to really get a picture of who we're trying to serve, mm-hmm. and then bringing that back in. Mm. So that's, I think that's the first thing. So really having an understanding of the user, what is it they want to achieve? What are the goals, mm-hmm. and why do they want to achieve them? So their motivations, mm-hmm. those three things. And then one of the ways in which I've done that is using personas. I know they get a bit
controversial.
I know they get a bit of a bad rap if you read certain people on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But I found it an incredibly useful tool to communicate kind of everything that's in my head from having talked to all of these people, 60, 70 interviews over mm-hmm. 12 months. So it's kind of like a vehicle or a vessel by which you can communicate who the customers are and what they need.
Yeah, in a meaningful way, kind of.
Exactly.
I was joking when I said controversial. Like, I do believe in the use of good personas. I think they do have a bit of a bad rap because a lot of the time people would associate them with more of a kind of a marketing type thing, maybe a little bit more woolly around their motivations and all that type of stuff, and not really kind of focusing on their goals and in a real, you know, insightful way.
Well, I've seen really bad personas, put it that way. Yeah. So just as a designer can produce really bad designs,
yeah.
a researcher can produce really bad personas.
Yeah.
I've seen them just based on pure fiction, and where someone doesn't know how to fill out a persona, mm-hmm. they fill it with guff, like this person has two dogs, walks to work, you know. These are not useful, and that's why personas get a bad rap, is because I think people have seen bad ones.
Mm.
But I don't think there's a higher proportion of bad personas than good or bad anything else, any other artifacts in design.
So the chosen vessel or, you know, communication tool was personas. Was there a reason why you chose that over the likes of jobs to be done or a different type of framework like that? Or have you tried a bit of each, or is there a mixture, or how does that work?
Yeah, good question. I think with jobs to be done, you know, I have used them before.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're necessarily bad, and personas are good or vice versa. But what I want to bring a little bit more humanity into the room,
mm-hmm.
you know, and personas kind of, you have a bit more narrative around the stuff, but nothing in the persona can't be linked back to research we've undertaken. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't try and make them overly human by introducing pets or children,
mm-hmm.
Or any guff like this person is busy. Well,
yeah.
That's not helpful. Everyone's busy.
So can you give us an example of like a good insight that you brought from the research into a specific or particular persona?
Yeah, sure. I suppose one thing that's worth sharing is when we went out to talk to people, regardless of whether they were in a small company or a really large company, some of their goals were very, very similar, if not the same. Mm. So that's the that's what you're intending to do with the persona, is looking at, well, what are the patterns of behavior? What are the patterns around goals and motivations? And one of the things was how people look at their transaction history or their statements. Mm-hmm. So when we talk to people, so accounts payable or accounts receivable, mm-hmm. Or the person that runs the whole show, be they the business owner or just the accounts person, because there's only one of them, we identified kind of four jobs or four tasks they undertake when they look at their transactions. One is to see if they've been paid yet. Mm-hmm. So cash flow is important mm-hmm. in any company. So that before they make payments or do payroll, they need to see if that payment in. Mm-hmm. So that's a simple matter of going into your transaction history. This is the current behavior and checking, have we been paid yet? So mm-hmm. it's normally at the top of the screen.
Yeah.
With the most recent transactions. That's an easy one. And then you can add certain filters to say, well, just show me all the incoming transactions. You can add a date filter on top of that if you've got a lot of stuff in to see, well, were we paid it on a certain date last week? So that's one really important job that people do all the time.
Yeah.
How that need is actually solved right now is by people logging in multiple times a day to check if they've been paid. Mm-hmm. There are clearly better ways to solve for that problem, but the need will always remain the same. And that's the beauty of looking at needs and looking at personas' goals. That goal should be constant regardless of time or technology. Mm-hmm. There would be better ways to solve it, certainly. If you got a text message or a notification that you've been paid, wouldn't yeah. that be fantastic? Mm. But I'm sure there are other ways to do it as well.
Yeah.
So that was one job that we identified. Another one was just to check a payment. So someone is querying, were they paid too much, too little? Were they paid at all? Mm-hmm. So again, it means to search your transactions. Mm-hmm. So that's another simple one, using multiple query types or filters like amount. I know it was a certain amount. I know it was an incoming payment or an outgoing payment. I know it was around a certain day. Mm-hmm. So again, you can think about the feature that might support that mm-hmm. Particular job. Funnily, one thing we discovered, and it was one of the most prominent components on the form, was the search description. But it's the least trusted piece of the interface, because if I pay you, Tom, and I just use the word thanks in the what they call the narrative, mm-hmm. When that arrives in your statement, you will not see who paid you. You'll say you'll see someone paid you €100,
and
you'll say the word thanks. And actually, universally, this narrative, what bankers call narratives or statement messages, causes the most problems throughout. So I know we've been paid $5,000. I don't know who the hell has paid us. Hmm. So I ring the bank and check, you know, yeah. do you know who paid us? Hmm. I ring my customers and to check, have they paid us? Hmm. You know, because I can't see it.
Yeah.
So it was one of the least trusted pieces in the screen, if you like.
Yeah, on that point, I remember when we got our house rewired, which I seem to mention quite often in this podcast for some reason.
It's a common thread. It's a common wire that goes through all.
But I remember the electrician who we were paying did all the work. He said to make sure when you're putting the money through, you in the comment put the address along with the money. And one of the funny things is, like, I made sure to do that, but it was like a character limit. So I kept had to kind of keep
18 characters.
Yeah, I kept running out of space and kind of and put in my address and then kind of truncate some of the words to make sure it made sense to them. I'm sure they could have found it, otherwise they'd have to look at the value and then kind of cross reference it with invoices and all that type of stuff. But it's funny that that's such an important feature from receiving payments, and yeah, that's interesting. It's the least trusted one, but maybe can we get some more character count in there instead of 18?
Well, you'd have to ask the payment schemes. This is, I've learned a ton about banking. So yeah. We could add as many as we like, but if the payment scheme like SEPA or SWIFT that transfers the actual message for the transfer of funds, if they don't support it,
yeah.
there's very little we can do.
Yeah,
but
okay. Let you off of that one.
But we'll try. We'll do our best. But the interesting thing about that digitization of payments and banking is that in the olden days, and we're not talking that long ago in terms of businesses, when they paid you, they pay by check, and the check will come in the post.
Yeah.
And in the post will also come a remittance slip saying, thank you very much, invoice number such and such. So it would go along with the payment. Mm. Nowadays, the payment comes almost instantly, but the remittance might be sent by email at the end of the week. And you can't correlate the two, and they come by different mediums.
Interesting.
You know, so yeah. In digitizing these things, we've not taken what works. So people are literally asking for, is there some way to send remittance digitally now? without me having to write an email to someone with the proof of the payment. And some of the fintechs do it and do it well. So you can add an attachment, you can send a message as the payment has been made. Some accounting packages solve the same problem. So as you mark an invoice as paid, an email is sent to the supplier. You know, so it's kind of interesting in how digitization has created other problems. You've solved one, but created another.
That is funny, because you just assume everything, when something is digitized, it's just automatically better. It's automatically more efficient and that kind of thing. But the asynchronous delivery of those messages, maybe?
Exactly.
It wasn't in the real world. It'd take more time for the letter and the check to get there, but it's, at least they're there physically beside each other in the same thing. That's interesting, yeah.
And exactly. And with checks, if I send a check to you, Tom, I'd be sitting that money for an extra week or 2 weeks, could be living off the interest, could be using it for other things, could be waiting on a payment to come in before the payment goes. But technically, I've paid you. So checks aren't necessarily a bad thing. And that's why they haven't really been phased out. We've seen customers who still rely on checks for that reason.
Yeah.
And we've seen recipients of checks put them away into their drawers and say, I won't cash that for 3 months because it's a different quarter and maybe I won't report my numbers until I actually cash it because it's not in my account.
Yeah.
And then that causes huge cash flow problems on the company who sent you the check. They don't know how many checks are out there in circulation, how many have been cashed, how many haven't. So
interesting. It reminds me of that episode of Seinfeld where he just like decides he never cashes the checks that he gets sent on his birthday from his aunt or something. He decides to, someone convinced him to do to check to cash them all, so he cashes them all in one go and wipes out our funds. So.
Well, exactly, and that can happen. No, but back to personas. You know, they were just one tool that I felt were a fit for the job I was trying to do, which was to communicate the kind of rich tapestry of the user needs out there from small to large companies and to kind of engender a little bit of empathy in the room along with other things like getting people to come into to user interviews and user testing sessions, sending clips out via Slack, short little clips, presenting kind of what we understood in little snippets to the various teams around the bank that needs to understand why it was so important they got some of this stuff right, because here's a customer at the other end and here's what they actually want rather than here's what you think they want. Because I think we all suffer from it from time to time, this cognitive bias of the false consensus effect where we think other people are like us.
Yeah.
You know, and actually we don't walk in their shoes as much as we should. So that's great part of my job is to bring the kind of user needs in.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's a great point actually. And I think the designers of in all different projects or companies make that mistake. I think it's like a natural mistake that we make. It's that you assume that everyone else is as tech savvy as you are, that they think about things the same way, that they buy, you know, the latest models of phones and that kind of thing. When actually, you know, it can be quite humbling when you do that research or put the time in and tests and all that type of stuff, that you understand that no, we actually don't understand. We made all these false assumptions. And if we just like bulldozered ahead building software based on our assumptions and what we think people think, well, you could lose a lot of money.
One of the ones I come across again and again, despite mobile being around since, was it 07, since the iPhone?
Yeah.
But that's kind of the year I think mobile really kind of started to kind of lift off. One of the assumptions is mobile is just for people on the go, and or the opposite of that, which is people would never want to do that on their mobile. And those assumptions have always been proved wrong. And again, talking to customers of the bank, we went out a very successful coffee shop chain. Talking to the owner there, he actually is a colleague called Craig. And while talking to him, he says, "Oh, that's Craig ringing." And I went, right, okay, what does Craig want? He wants to know if we've been paid yet so I can send out the coffee machine. And the coffee machine was probably worth multiple thousands of euro to a shop, I guess. We can't ship that until we know we've been paid because, you know, the check is in the post kind of stuff. But I said, all right, well, what do you do now? And he goes, well, now I have to go upstairs. I have to log into my online banking with my DigiPass. And if I've left my DigiPass at home, I can't do it till tomorrow.
Right.
And it's going to take about 10 minutes. And I said, well, what would you rather do? And he just pointed his phone at me and said, well, you know, I can check all my point of sale transactions on my phone. How well are we doing across all our shops
Yeah.
on the mobile phone? So that context of people being on their feet, people being busy, people actually trying to run a business, not trying to log into banking to find answers they need. So, you know, a good solution for him is possibly, you know, some sort of notification, whether that be push or SMS or something like that, where he can have that answer before Craig even rings him looking with the question, you know. So I think it's...
That is interesting, because I even found, like, I got, like, not so long ago, got a Galaxy Watch. It was my first smartwatch, and I found that it's almost like a shortcut between information on my phone and my wrist. So I look at my phone less, because, like, a lot of notifications come. When my phone vibrates and I see it on my watch, I can kind of say, oh, yeah, you know, I don't need to pick it up as much.
Then people think you're checking the time and you want to get out of there.
Yeah, that is the thing, yeah. So you look rude. Yeah, you do that in the queue. You know, you'd get a messenger waiting for coffee or something, and people are like, oh, it's right with you now, sir. And I'm like, sorry.
No, but by going out and understanding how people work, the context in which they work, all that richness, if you can bring that in, you have a really good answer to, you know, to people who might make assumptions like people wouldn't want to do that on their phone. Or mobile is just on the go. Actually, mobile is everything, you know, is kind of the answer that we got from that one, you know. So people expect to be able to do everything on their phones now, if not their smartwatches.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but I think that, as you mentioned in the past, I've noticed that it's something very, like, just convincing around seeing video footage of someone in context, real people, you know, given their point of view on something. It's very convincing, as opposed to you could say, like, well, you know, you could say verbally or in a deck, you know, users think this, this, and this, and you're like, oh yeah, great, brilliant. But there's something just very real about looking at a other human, even if it's in just a snip of a video.
Yeah, particularly in a moment of struggle where they actually can't figure out the thing you just made. You know, so I think that's the penny really drops there. Actually, we need to do more of this all the time. Research is not a big discovery project. It's probably not an appetite or budget for doing a lot of that these days. But constant customer contact, I think, is the way forward. So a little bit often. And that's working within a product team. That's the only way we can work. You know, so we're working on the next set of features. Okay, what do we need to know that we don't know right now? Where are we not confident?
Yeah.
So let's talk to a handful of customers. Let's do it next week. You know.
And around the personas, like, so when you were mentioning some of the things that the tasks that they're doing, the goals or whatever, you were framing them around almost around jobs. Like, this is the job they're doing, and they're doing this job, and then do this job. And do you bring them together in a persona? And do you find people, you know, people that necessarily wouldn't have in the past, maybe they're developers, maybe they're other people, they're looking at this artifact or this piece of documentation and saying, well, oh, you understand this person is trying to do this, this, and this, and this is why. Like, have you found that there's a change around how the communication around that, or do they refer to a person as opposed to just a ticket in Jira?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So personas are, you mentioned a document, you know, the worst thing that can be is just a document or an artifact that sits on the shelves. Yeah. They've got to be a useful living thing. So one of the ways we've kind of socialized them is we use Slack and we use Jira and we use Confluence, kind of a wiki. Sharing them, first of all, on Slack, presenting them in the room at a workshop. So just as a reminder, these are the guys we're designing for. Just to try and avoid that self-referential design and that kind of, again, that false consensus effect from setting in. Then you in Jira Stories, we've started to kind of introduce them, you know, rather than saying as a user, it's like as, you know, someone from the persona name, from accounts payable, you know, so actually with a hyperlink back to the persona.
Yeah.
So again, it's trying to kind of spread them and socialize them and remind people that they're there and they're useful. I think that has been quite successful, you know, so it's, but we're not there yet. You know, we've got to keep kind of hammering it home that we're designing for customers and needs may change. But often we found that the needs actually don't. Like that checking your transaction stuff. Anytime people are running a business, they will need to do these things. They will be better served. So to bore you with a bit of banking stuff, open banking has come to the UK. It's coming to Ireland, the rest of the EU, come September. Which means that other software can literally pull your transactions out and do cool stuff with them. So one of the use cases in business is one of the jobs, I don't think I mentioned, was reconciliation. So that's basically making sure you've paid for everything you're meant to pay for. So you've met your commitments and you've been paid for all your outstanding invoices. And it can be quite a manual process from the people we've looked at. Some do a printout, they do it on paper. And that's actually quite a fast process. They're literally crossing stuff off. Other people do it on screen where they're flicking between Excel and their invoicing package. But the more progressive companies are now saying, well, is there a feed we can get into, you know, Sage or Xero, these accounting packages? And because they don't have a bookkeeper, they've got a CFO who's quite strategic about how they manage their money. He doesn't want to do, or she doesn't want to do manual work. So this promise of open banking feeds will actually reduce the amount of work. It'll just pull it all in and basically tot it all up, do the comparison checks, and you'll just have to tick some of the exceptions. So the job remains the same, but the solution now is a faster thing, so that month end can take days. You hear of accounting teams in places we've worked before, don't bother me with this, I'm doing my month end. If you get your expenses in late, good luck, because they're doing month end. And it's a pain in terms of manual labor. And it can take 2 to 3 days to sign off on accounts. And it's an important part of running a business in a proper way. As we know from the FAI news, the Football Association of Ireland have not been doing this, apparently. But again, feeds will cut that down from days to potentially minutes.
So there's a whole new world of possibilities where you could have
exactly
your information presented to you. So that's a regulation thing. So the banks have to adhere to that. Doesn't sound like that's something they're going to be too happy about, because it means that there are more competitors, neobanks and stuff will have access to this, or new fintech startups and that kind of stuff will be able to have access to this information.
Sure.
With your consent.
Yeah, with the customer's consent, of course. But I think competition is good in general. I think it will drive innovation from the big banks, like the one I work for. But we can also become consumers of this ourselves, so we can create services around it.
Yeah.
So it's not just limited to fintechs or accounting packages. So there's no reason why we can't do the same.
But it
has been an interesting couple of months just focusing on open banking. But we can clearly see the customer benefit.
So you've had some success with research. I feel like there's a lot of times we talk about research, we talk about the positives, we sort of focus on the positives, focus on like the benefits of it and the reasons we should do it. I wonder from your experience, are there anecdotes or any kind of experiences you have where it's hasn't been good, or it's sort of led to something unplanned or negative? You know, like, was there any cases that you can point to where it's like a pitfall of research?
That's a good one. Largely, they've been very positive experiences for both the design team and the client that I've been working with. But it can be dangerous. Research can be dangerous in the sense that it can question or invalidate assumptions senior executives have made. So you may be advocating for a change in direction, even if you don't mean to be. You could be questioning some of the statements or assumptions they've made before you were on the scene. So you've got to be careful about that kind of stuff. But also, if research is done poorly, it gets a bad reputation. You know, so again, that's not the researcher's fault, it's the researcher. I think if you're thorough, if you're rigorous, you know, I think research is always a good thing. But again, it doesn't have to be a big discovery phase. It can be a very small discovery phase. We've been, over the years, very constrained in the amount of time or budget that was available to us. But you've got to make do with what you can. You kind of cut your cloth. That's about three cliches in one sentence.
There's a phrase that you used before when you're talking about research, especially when it comes to someone being handed over from a third party. So if someone else does the research and hands it over to you, it's kind of like looking at someone else's photos of their holiday. I don't know if you originated that, but I remember you telling me anyway. It's like trying to understand someone's holiday, but looking at the photos by someone else. You know, so it's kind of like there is a disconnect there. And I suppose with us, the way we used to work, we'd be very hands-on with the research. We're involved in it. It's not really a kind of someone else handing you this deck this report that you've got to then work with, decipher and work with.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad place to start. You know, designers may get a bad rap and research might get a bad rap because every design team that wants to come on wants to start from scratch again.
Yeah.
When actually there might be all these reports that are actually quite good.
Yeah.
Work that's gone on before, which you should assume at least there was good intentions behind.
Mm.
Your job isn't necessary to question the validity of that research. You know, it's not peer review and academic research.
Mm.
And actually the company may have already got relationships and paid for this research.
Yeah.
Like with SuperValu a couple of years ago, there's really good research done. So we didn't have to do it.
Mm.
But we did continuous research during it. You know, we went out and observed how people shopped in supermarkets and how they picked vegetables
mm.
from the aisles. What could we apply from the physical world to the online or digital world? Went to visit people in their homes on how they planned their shop and how they received their shop from the delivery perspective.
Yeah.
But it was very light and continuous rather than big expensive discovery, because big expensive discovery had just been paid for.
Yeah.
Just happened to be by a different team.
Mm.
And you will get specialisms and they have started to emerge, like pure researchers.
Yeah.
You know, and then product designers. If you throw stuff over the wall, it will not work when you've got those specialisms in your organization.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to work together so that, you know, as researcher brings people with them on research,
mm-hmm.
the designer includes the research, you know, in some mm-hmm. of the activities in design.
Yeah. So there's an overlap within the teams.
Exactly.
Somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But and if you have that overlap, like that's sort of the design development over, like making sure there's an overlap there as that those projects are handed over and all of that is clear. And then in a world that design and research start to separate more, which seems to be a trend, seems mm. to be kind of how things are moving and generally, maybe as long as there's an overlap, maybe you're sort of covered. I don't know. Do you see research being intrinsically tied to design, or is it just sort of UX as an industry just sort of included both up till now? And that's the way it is.
I think it has included both, but I think what I would value in research is that they spend time with the problem, not solutions. I don't want to hear about solutions if you're doing research. I want to hear what is the nub of the problem? Who are our users? What are they trying to do really? And really getting deeper in that stuff. What are the real unmet needs?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas designer is more about, well, what are the possible solutions to the problems and mm. making sure that those problems are really well understood and really clearly stated and communicated.
Mm-hmm.
That this is actually what we're trying to do, not what you thought it was.
Yeah.
So light research can spend a little bit, it can be too, not deep enough. You can often jump to conclusions. You know, you go straight from observation to conclusion,
and yeah.
not the analysis and the synthesis that needs to happen
yeah.
between the research and the design.
Yeah.
You know, that's what, you know, that can often be invisible and therefore viewed upon as magic by clients. Mm. So that's why creatives are, you know, they've got a kind of certain cliched aura about them, and that just they're just creative and magic happens. Well, actually, no, there's an active synthesis that needs to happen. It just happens invisibly in lots of places, mm-hmm. but it actually should be visible and collaborative.
Yeah.
And that's where you go from observation to insight to
mm-hmm.
design taking form,
mm-hmm.
you know. So
how do you know how deep to go? Because, you know, I've been on kind of research studies before that we've had, so one of the companies I used to work with, we had access to a lot of users. We could throw out a call for interviews and we get a bunch of responses and we had plenty of information. And then there's other situations where if you can get five people to the table, that's going to be your best case scenario. And, you know, there's probably different opinions on like how deep you need to go. Like with five users, are you able to uncover the bulk of things, or do you need a bigger kind of sample size? I don't know, like just generally speaking, do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I've seen research where there's been claims made that, oh, we've done 2,000 interviews. And they haven't done any interviews. They've done a questionnaire over the phone.
Yeah.
Which is a different thing. So the questionnaire may have been well designed, mm-hmm. but it's still a questionnaire or a survey. So they're spending very little time with lots of users, whereas I'd flip it and say, well, can you spend a lot of time with fewer users?
Yeah.
So you can get a lot from 10 interviews. Now, it depends on your domain. So bringing it back to business banking, we've got companies of all shapes and sizes and of all different types of industry that are customers of the bank. So between farmers and high-tech startups to one-man bands, coffee shops. But if you interview enough of those, you start to see patterns emerge that what they're actually trying to do is quite similar. Whatever about their businesses being the same, we can give them tools to help them manage their business and just not get in their way. Mm. You know, so I would always advocate for doing more of the field study type work. So going out and actually talking to people in their environments. And after 5 or after 10, you can say, well, what do we know now? Does it give us confidence to move on? There's a good book called Just Enough Research. I think it's by Erica Hall. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong that, but...
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, so it doesn't... Again, back to that point, it doesn't have to be a big discovery. It can be just enough.
Yeah.
You know, and again, you need a sense of confidence of, well, do we have enough yet? Mm-hmm. Can we make progress? Can we get something out of what we know? Yeah, yeah, but we'll have to go back to the well to learn a bit more.
Yeah.
So I would, rather than the ideas first approach where you ship something and then learn, mm-hmm. learn something first. You know, get your foundations right and then build something. At least you'll know, you'll have the confidence that you're on the right track mm-hmm. Before you go out. Because what's not said is that in lots of industries, with existing customers, you don't have a second chance to get it right. You know, there's a trust issue with, particularly with financial services. If we get something wrong, you know, it's front page news, you know? Mm. So we need that degree of confidence. Mm-hmm. For a hot young startup, maybe they can pivot faster and ship something fast and have another cohort of customers that haven't seen the first version or who are willing to forgive them one or two, you know, little missteps, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You could even point to the Revolut Slack screen grab that was thrown around a while back by their CFO talking about people wanting to people to work weekends and all that kind of stuff, and they managed to turn that around again.
Like, yeah,
you know, basically using the leverage that they're a smaller company, they need to be a bit more aggressive and all that, but that's not the long term approach.
Mm.
Something you're saying there, but you're talking about, it sounds like you're just saying more like quality over quantity. As you're saying, like, you send out a survey to thousands of people, you're getting more people looking at, you know, less quality from more people. And you were talking about the user test, the research that you're doing and some of the testing as well in context, like in people's homes. And one of the things we talked about in the podcast before, I'm sure many people have thought about this as well, is when it comes to user testing, you know, you're bringing someone into it, like this alien environment. It's kind of like very, what's the word, it's kind of an artificial setup, you know, sit at this desk, there might be eye tracking, even, like, you know, there's a camera here watching you, ignore that, there's a microphone there, kind of ignore that as well. And I remember the super value research that you did, if I remember correctly, it was much more kind of an ambient thing. They were in people's kitchens while they were using their laptop with a cup of tea beside them, and the camera was much more low key. It was at an angle down to the side. It just seemed a bit...
It was out of the way, yeah.
Yeah,
out of
the way.
It was less obtrusive, but we're still there, present in someone's house, and we're strangers and we're asking questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's probably less... They're probably more comfortable in their own surroundings.
Yeah. And did you find any kind of extra insights from that, from being in their environment?
Looking back at that one, that was a really interesting one. So just, you know, where shopping fits in, you know, they don't sit in a lab for an hour to do their online shopping. They're doing it between picking kids up from ballet or football, or while getting the dinner on, or while holding the baby with a phone in their hand.
Mm-hmm.
What we did see an awful lot of, and I hadn't heard of them in such a big way before, was this thing called a slow cooker.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a pot that that has a electricity supply. You plug it in at a low temperature and it cooks your meal over 6 or 8 hours. And the number of, I don't know if it was chance, and again, I wouldn't necessarily infer a market size out of this, more kind of the pattern of convenience around slow cooking, like people putting a meal on, not having time to do it in the evening, so they put it on in the morning and it's ready for when they come back, or when the kids come back from school. So this whole slow cooker movement. But that kind of idea could fit into a kind of a content marketing approach, like recipes for slow cookers.
Mm.
You know, I've since bought one myself and do a pretty mean lamb to Gene. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm impressed how slow cookers are not, like, well known here. Like, I was amazed when I met somebody who didn't know what a slow cooker was. Like, that's sort of part of the culture I was raised in.
Yeah.
We're a backward little country here, you know?
You are. It took a while for slow cookers to get over it.
We're slow learners.
But they're here now, and apparently firemen hate them. So,
do they make fires?
Apparently they can do, yeah.
Yeah.
If they're cheap, or if they're, I don't know. But
it's a great tool. I think we should move the conversation to slow cookers. What's your favorite slow cooker dish? Lamb tagine. We got lamb tagine.
Amazing.
So you can bring lamb tagine instead of donuts next time.
Yeah.
You can bring donuts too as well if you want, but bring the tagine. Awesome.
Well, we could downstairs to Fallon and Burn, and we could buy the ingredients there and just pop it all in. Cook it here.
Just bring it here, yeah. Just leave it on. Have a marathon podcast session. Yeah.
So I think personas get criticism, and sometimes I resonate with the criticism that they get. I think, I've made probably bad personas in my career, and really thinking about them as like an artifact, a thing that I need to produce that needs to look nice and be readable and be enjoyable, and then hopefully leads to something, but it could be based in kind of fluff. Right, like maybe the emphasis is on that artifact creating the thing. I wonder, like, you have spent time thinking about this, you've spent time obviously working with personas in particular at the bank, how do you approach it so you overcome the possible issues with personas?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing, back to first principles, you're trying to understand the user, what their goals are, what their motivations are. Three things, okay? The best way you do that is go out and interview people, okay? So field studies, you ask them very open questions. So that's the art of good interviews. But once you've done that, you need a container. So something that contains what you know, and you need a container to communicate what you know to the wider team, because you can't all be out interviewing customers all the time. And then you've done 100 interviews over a year, or close to it, you need a reminder of what you know. And then I suppose you need a lens by which you can evaluate what you're going to build or what you have built. So do we think this will fit the needs of the people we've talked to? So personas are just a model that does all of those things. So contains what you know, communicates what you know, reminds you of what you know. There are other models. So there's a nice quote about models, that all models are wrong, but some are useful. I once tried to travel from Heathrow to Uxbridge, and I looked at the tube map to try and understand how I'd get there using, a train. So that involved getting, a train for about 45 minutes towards the centre of London, and another one back out for about 45 minutes towards Uxbridge, because they looked very far apart on the tube map. Mm. This is a classic, what this model is for and what it's not for. When I got there, sweating, just about in enough time, the people I was going to visit were laughing, saying, like, it's 10 minutes in a cab. What are you doing? And a fiver. So less than the cost of the trains and far less time spent doing it. So the point there is, it is a great map if you know you need to travel by train in London. It's not good as a map for topology and judging distances between places.
It's abstracted away from
what we
as humans understand with distance and that kind of thing.
So personas are not real people. They will have some biases in them. But if you go back to the first principles, what they're trying to do, they're just trying to communicate what you know about your users. Listen, you can use other models. You can use jobs to be done. You can use customer journey maps. You can use mental models. All ways in which to describe what the needs or the unmet needs are for customers out there. And the other thing is, personas, while they get a bit of bad rap on the likes of Twitter, they're nothing without scenarios. They're really the actors. The scenarios are the plot by which you're trying to imagine a better future. So you need to write some what we call in the business context scenarios of that shows what the kind of a day in the life of or an experience for this persona actually is. So personas without scenarios are like actors without a movie, So I think, but again, I'm okay if you've done the rigorous research, you've done the analysis and the synthesis, and the output of some of that synthesis is a different model. As long as it can concisely communicate the needs of the users, I don't mind. But in the more recent experience, I think they were the right fit.
Yeah.
So bring a bit more humanity in, because if you look at software and how user stories are written, as a user, I want to do X because Y. That's kind of cloaked in user type language, but it may not have any foundation. There may not be any background or foundation to the research that led to that user story, but yet we're cloaking or masking these requirements in user type language. And that can be dangerous, because there was no research done potentially when you read a user story, but it looks like there was.
So it's kind of just framed in this in this template or whatever, almost that just all we need to just slot it in there, and then it makes sense. It fits in with everything else, and it looks like it makes sense. Like,
yeah, it's the way you now write requirements, and actually, it's not how requirements are written; it's how features are written.
Yeah,
it's not a requirement. The requirement is what the need that the user has. The feature is one of the solutions by which you meet that need.
Mm-hmm.
But we write features as if they were requirements.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's a kind of a dangerous line to thread.
Yeah.
Be very clear on the user needs you're trying to fulfill.
Yeah, it's like, where's the line between creative writing and user research? It's like, I could easily like sit and just like you're writing a piece of fiction, just create a bunch of problem statements that need to be solved and need to be designed for.
But I wouldn't discount the art of storytelling and how storytelling can be really powerful and helpful in moving people in a certain direction or to bring something to life.
Yeah.
So there is a place for fiction and storytelling. Mm-hmm. I would say the storytelling should be more around the future experience you want to create without being too...
So it should be fiction based on a true story.
Kind of. I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
Based on real events.
Yeah, but personas should not be fictional. They should be based on rigorous user research. Yeah. Just like jobs to be done should be, or like any other mental model or customer journey map. There should be a rigor there that preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's talk about proto-personas as well, which is what everyone in the room thinks. But because of the false consensus effect, what everyone in the room thinks about who the users are, what they need, probably isn't enough. You know, and you might think you're done once you've done that piece, you know, which is the problem with brainstorming. It's just, it's the cumulative output of just the people in the room and you haven't actually left it.
Yeah.
Does it even include all the people in the room, or is it just the person who's the loudest and
exactly.
What is it? The highest paid, the hippo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if back to the storytelling, if you think about what scenarios actually are, they are small stories. These, the power of storytelling to communicate the human experience of the interaction you're trying to design for. What you're actually aiming for is this shared understanding of user needs.
Yeah.
You know, because as a researcher, I might have an understanding of what I think customers need.
Mm.
Some product manager, a business analyst, a developer might have completely different perspectives.
Yeah.
So it's about kind of using a tool or a method to communicate ideas.
Yeah. It brings more clarity to the communications, because you could have in your head like each five people could be sitting around a table or more and kind of go, words can be said, and in their head they're forming this picture or maybe these experiences they've in the past, or they're thinking about a person they know or something that kind of fits into that what's being said, when actually they could all be off. Whereas like if you manifest it into something that's, you know, whatever kind of artifact it is, if it's personas or whatever, but it communicates more in a kind of succinct way, in an accurate way that everyone can kind of point to and go, ah, we all understand that. Yeah. Mm. Like, so with the imaginary stuff that I've got going on in my head is different to yours, but what we're all reading there, we're all agreeing on understanding that for how the person thinks and what motivates them. It makes it a bit more tangible.
Yeah. I think you're talking about language being the wrong medium in which to describe an experience or design of an experience, because it's so ambiguous.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the problems with the way software was built. It was all requirements in English.
Yeah.
And then people would interpret that differently. Whereas, like personas and scenarios in this case, what they're about is trying to imagine what a better experience for our users will actually be like, without getting too bogged down in the detail. That obviously comes much later.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose that the focus is on the human experience of what you're trying to build. So what will it be like when someone interacts with our product before the product has even been really formed?
Yeah.
Rather than the technology-led approach of, you know, gizmos and widgets and components and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so it's away from technology towards a more human approach.
That's a great point to end the podcast on, I think. Lara, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Lara. It's great to have you on.
Thanks,
Frank. For the folks listening, is there a place on the internet that they can find you?
They can find me on Twitter, Lawrence Veal, where I'm posting dog photos of my new dog, and they can find me on LinkedIn. There are not many Lawrence Veals around, so you should find me pretty easily.
It's V-E-A-L-E.
Meet to please you.
Yeah. Great, Craig. Where can we get you online?
Instagram, Craig5446. And I write on Medium too.
Yeah. And I'm on Twitter mostly, at Tom C Design. You can find me on LinkedIn also, Tom Cunningham.
There you have it. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.